This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruston, today we have BFM's finest. The return of, he is a producer here on The Morning Run, and he is Sim Wee Boon.
Hello, hello, good to be here.
Great to have you. And we also have the return of a video producer, he is Faik Shazwan.
Hello.
Hi. And our three topics this week are, topic number one is the hollowing out of city centres. Topic number two is devised theatre. And finally, topic number three, how come old people hate Marvel?
Not all old people. just several very venerable people.
Okay, all right. Well, how come some venerable old people hate Marvel movies? So, with topic number one, Petaling Street, Chinatown, Kuala Lumpur. You know, I used to know a guy. He's a little bit older than me. And so he'd be, I don't know, 55 or something. And he told me how when he was about 10 years old, he used to go down to Petaling Street and he would have to sit next to his father in one of the upstairs rooms and clean out his opium pipe.
Cool. So, yeah, the good old days.
The good old days. That would have been early 1970s. So the other day, I went down to Petaling Street for the first time in quite a while. And I went to, amongst other places, the new old Rex Cinema, which has been redone as a art space, as a venue. The cinema itself is completely hollowed out now, but you can still get the shape of the tiering of the floor, high ceiling. I thought it was really gorgeous. And it's where producer Ali was telling me back in the day he would go there to watch Jurassic Park, because it had the best sound and the best rats as well, producer Ali, wasn't it? So one of the phenomena that's been happening around the world is the hollowing out of city centers, that the downtown area, people have been leaving. They no longer live there. They go live in the suburbs or they go live in the exurbs. And life in the center has disappeared. But there are now these spaces in downtown where life may not be as lively as it once was, but there are spaces that are available. And I'm just wondering, is there a viable way to revive them? Do people want to go back downtown? So, for instance, I also went to Quill Mall. You know Quill Mall?
Yeah, yeah. It's a pretty... No one really goes there.
Nobody goes there. It was like there was nothing there. I mean, these are spaces which are burning up money for somebody, and something could be done with them. But you two, Sim, you're originally from Sarawak, but you were kind of raised here in KL.
Yep.
And Faik, you are kind of a KL boy, sort of?
Kind of, I guess. Well, yeah, Shalom, maybe.
So you have no connection
to
downtown.
That's very far from KL.
Yeah, you got no connection to downtown.
No, yeah.
I mean, so would you...
I mean, like, I know, I've been to Petaling Street.
But you have no... It's like, eh, it's whatever. Nothing,
yeah. Well, I mean... There's no, like... I mean... In terms of connection, I mean, I do go to downtown.
Yeah.
You know? I have gone to downtown when I was young.
Yeah.
When I was old, I mean, I was at downtown like maybe 2 weeks ago. Can't remember for what, but you know.
So yeah. you are a returnee to the downtown area. You're giving the life, are you?
For me, I think for most people, right, the city, you don't really live there. You commute there. The city is the epicenter of work. You know, that's I mean, you get that in London and everywhere. You know? I mean, yeah, I know there's people that live there and all, but, you know, life doesn't really thrive there. Life thrives outside the city, the family, pets and all that jazz. I mean, there are some small set, like expats and really rich people and whatnot, but most of the time, the city for me, and I think for most people, is a place you go to work or a place to go to shop or watch a movie, you know,
right,
or watch theatre or something. So it's a destination.
But you could live there.
You could. It's very expensive or very...
No, not necessarily. Yeah. You could get a shop house and you could live there.
The assumption is that it's very expensive, lah.
Yeah.
To live downtown.
Well, you look at Georgetown, okay?
Yeah.
Penang. This is one area where there's been a real attempt, concerted attempt to regenerate downtown. And I was talking to older Penangites who were saying that back in the 70s and 80s, Georgetown was this no-go zone. It was dark. There were fights. It was gangstery. No one ever went there. They were all out in Pulau Tikus. They were in the suburbs, living happy suburban lives. Then there's been this UNESCOization, and if you go to downtown Georgetown, there are bars and there are people there. But Penangites themselves, from my conversations anyway, don't seem to really go to Georgetown?
I think it's because of the tourists and the price. You know, I think I'm pretty sure there was at a certain point in time where they enjoyed going there to eat, to hang out and all, but because it's so commercialized now, at least according to them. I mean, I like Georgetown, you know, but when I go there, I'm a tourist. So I think it kind of like makes them like ear away from wanting to go there, because they're like, I go there and there's like a whole flock of tourists, it's getting annoying, everything's expensive and stuff like that.
But
and,
yeah,
you know,
but that's also kind of the case for every kind of city,
yeah,
right? That's
yeah.
become a tourist attraction. You know, developers come in, build up this part of a particular town, and then the locals tend to move away from that because, you know, prices rise. It just doesn't feel like
it's
home
not
anymore.
Regional anymore.
Yeah.
For me, when I was younger, Petaling Street was a thing where me and my parents would go on the weekend. We go to the Chinatown, you know, buy mata kucing, you know, look at all the stuff around. You know, it was cool, it was fun, and it was a great activity for me. I always like want to buy some cheap toy or something like that, but you know, my dad would never let me buy. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot of bars that's open up there, and they're really cool bars. They make really nice drinks, you know, and restaurants as well, really nice restaurants. And like you said, Rec Scale open there. And they don't just do food, drinks, or whatever. They do activities like backlit cinema, you know, and, you know, they're bringing down performances and everything. I think they had like a musical theater kind of thing. So I do go there now. My friends do go there now. For me, it's not like it's an epicenter. It's just another destination.
Well, I wonder if we're just missing out on living in this city that doesn't have a center. Maybe we're missing out on not having a center. Maybe cities that have centers. Cooler.
I just kind of like right on what Sim was saying just now. I just remember like when I was a kid living in Shah Alam, like on the weekends we would think of like going to KLCC as like the most, like it was like a big adventure.
We need to plan it three weeks ahead.
Need to like, okay, we're gonna hit KLCC.
Yeah.
We're gonna take the KTM. You know, drop off at this station.
Are we taking the bus? Yeah. You know, is our friend's dad gonna send us there? Yeah. You know, a week before, like everyone got enough money. You know, 30 ringgit, 30 ringgit. You know, so yeah.
Okay, well we'll wrap this one up. But then, Fike, then if that's exciting, then you should go to Petaling Street because that'd be really exciting.
Sure. Yeah. I have. Yeah. It's nice.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay, well, we're going to wrap that one up, but I don't know. I quite like it down there. So
yeah, I do too. It's just sometimes really hot, and I guess I haven't gone because the past few months is either really bad haze, and now, I mean, if you're going to go, the rain, the jam, it's like, I'm just going to hang out in the car.
Typical KLI. So topic number two, Fike, Devise Theatre.
Yeah, Devise Theatre.
What is that?
Okay, so... Well, what Devise Theatre is that essentially, it's something that I do, that I participate in. But what it essentially is, it's a form of theatre. Whereas if you kind of understand, I'm not using this word in a, like a negative way or whatever, like maybe like straight theatre, like normal theatre, usually the process begins with a script, with a written play. And then the collaborators, the director, the performers, and so on and so forth would come in and kind of extract a performance from this from the compass, which is the written play. Whereas Devise Theatre kind of works backwards a little bit. So they usually don't begin with a set compass, right? They begin with the people. They begin with the performers, along with the director, along with whoever else is collaborating with the team. Essentially do research on a particular topic, and then the written text comes out of that process.
Bit by bit, slowly.
Yeah, yeah.
Organically, it emerges.
Yes, yes.
And you've done a lot of this, haven't you? With Five Arts Theatre. You know,
mostly with the Five Arts, yes.
And with Mark Tay.
Yes.
Yeah, the great Mark Tay. So why did you want to talk about Devise Theatre today? Because you've came across somebody who hates it.
Yeah, so I came across, I don't know if he hates it, but he had like quite a strong opinion about it. This is author, playwright, called Ridwan Saidi, and he has a blog. Post, but blog thing. It's called binfilm.blogspot.com.
Are you calling him out?
No, I'm not calling him out. No. So he wrote this.
It's going to be a rap battle.
No.
Theater battle.
So he wrote this. You know, he wrote this blog post. The title was Pemahaman Songsang Devise Theatre di Malaysia, and he talks about how he's getting kind of sick of all this devised theatre that has begun to appearing in Kuala Lumpur. When I read it, so he wrote a critique about devised theatre in KL or in Malaysia. But, you know, but when I read it, I quite related to what he was trying to say, even though the practice that I do is devised theatre.
So what's wrong with it? I've seen a lot of it.
Oh, so maybe some of the things that I share with what Ridwan wrote was that because it's very collaborative, because you begin, well, not always, but sometimes you begin with no text, the creators, the performers, would always tend to write very personal monologues. Not that that's not a good thing.
But like, I feel this upsets me.
Yes, that kind of stuff might come, sometimes maybe a bit, maybe preachy, I don't know.
Yeah,
So maybe sometimes device theater can kind of make that, dare I say it, mistake. Yeah. To go into that kind of...
Well, Sim, in a short while, you're going to be telling us why you think Marvel comic book films are the greatest things of all time.
So I'm one of the greatest things of all time.
So I'm assuming you're not a device theater aficionado.
Well, I'm not a theater aficionado. I mean, I've seen plays. You know, I've gone and seen plays. I don't know classification. I'm very sure I've seen a device theater play once. You know, I think what comes close is something. A friend of mine, Ho Lee Ching, she did something called OCD.
Mm.
But I'm not sure. Was that improv? Was that abstract? You know, I've seen Shakespearean type, you know, Queen Anne, Elizabeth. Yeah. But I don't know. Where I can relate from that is, it sounds like, you know, it's a very abstract form of creating art form or content, you know, and
it's primarily a process.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saying device theater is saying the process of making this particular.
Well, I'm going to quote a couple of examples of device theater, which I think have been very successful and really, really good. One done by Mark Tay. I don't know if you were in one of the many versions he did, where he took the found text, the actual documented words that were spoken at the Baling talks just shortly before independence, when there were discussions with the soon-to-be government of Tunku Abdurrahman and the communists of Jinping. And so these were people sitting around a table just talking. And then Mark Tay takes these actual words and then gives it not a theatric experience as in recreating people talking around a table, but just completely revolutionizing. People were on chairs walking as if they were on stilts and stuff, as if they were, you know, to illustrate that this was a delicate balancing act and people could collapse at any moment. And it was absolutely gripping because I was listening to the actual words that kind of formed the nation and this theater experience where I didn't know where the stage was and where it ended. It upended kind of traditional blocky sort of like the stage is just...
That sounds really cool. I mean, I don't see a problem with that. I mean, I don't know what that guy is.
So I wasn't in that particular piece that Mark did, but I am in an updated version of the Baling performance.
Oh, it's just rehashing the old stuff. Okay.
Rehashing the old, exactly. But now it there's no more kind of like standing on chairs and stuff. Now it's just, we're just reading the text.
Oh, okay.
But you're reading it in your own way, I guess?
Right.
Yes, I guess so. Yeah.
Whatever. I guess it reminds me of how when David Bowie would go on tour and he would like redo his old songs in very, very different styles.
I mean, a lot of bands and performers do that. And I mean, it's part of the experience. It's part of the contract you made when you agreed to go to a live show, be it a theater or concert. You know, that experience is to be different than other experiences. So, you know, if you go to one that's super preachy and you don't enjoy it, then, you know, like, I mean, like for me, I love the band Arctic Monkeys. You know, it was a dream of mine to watch them live.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I saw them live, they were disappointing, you know, because they played their last album and their last album wasn't that great, you know. And so that experience wasn't that great, you know, but it's not going to like
put you off the Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah, or put me off the genre, put me off something. I mean, not every experience they're going to have is going to be great.
Okay. Yeah. But you've also been, without naming names, Frank, you've been in productions which were not successful as an experience, theatrical experience?
Sure.
Devised pieces? What were the problems there?
So primarily the problem would be because we don't begin with a written play.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of self-investigation that needs to happen. And sometimes not being able to be clear about your motivations as to what you want to say.
You're saying you as in the director or you as the performers?
Us as the performers, but also us as collaborators.
Yeah.
Not managing to clarify the point.
Yeah.
That's when it becomes quite.
Yeah. And as an audience member, I can say that when it fails on that level, it's kind of embarrassing.
Yes, it can get quite embarrassing, yeah. Especially if you're a performer, you're on stage, you're trying to do this, you're trying to kind of like make it work, right? Because there's
a point.
Yeah, but there's also a whole bunch of eyes looking at you, yeah. Right? So you're trying your best, but it's really quite frustrating, quite saddening when, you know, you don't really know what you want to say.
But that's part of the process, I guess. I mean, you're not supposed to know every time, you know, every time when you go through something.
It is,
right?
But what Vaik is saying is that what he's doing is essentially performing the new Arctic Monkeys album, you know?
And I mean, there were like, people that stayed in that crowd.
Exactly. You know, there are some who do and some who don't. And it's a scary thing.
Yeah. But, you know, fear is what gives you life, I guess.
And then there are likes of Sim who are looking at you like, what? And he walks out.
I mean, I've been to place. I don't know if it's abstract or improv, but I've been to place where I left my head scratching, you know, and I'm like, what was that all about? But every time that happens, I take it as like, okay, maybe it was like at a level where I don't understand.
Yeah.
You know? But then I didn't consume as many artsy, whatever high level. But I just go back to like, okay, how did it make me feel? If it made me feel confused, maybe that's what it's all about. If it made me feel like, wee, alamak, kasihan, the actor was like crying all the time, like, you know, he must be going through something really sad, you know? I mean, when you watch something, when you listen to something, it's supposed to evoke something out of you, you know? So no matter you leave it confused, angry, sad, hateful, whatever, it worked to some level. It did something, yeah.
All right. So, Fight, you're going to be, despite the words of this critic, you're going to continue?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Of
and
should adjut him to do a play. You,
I would love to work with Redon's idea. Yeah,
well,
yeah.
Okay, do you have one coming up? Anything?
Most likely next year. We're working on a performance, a devised performance. Yes,
cool. Okay, all right.
Yeah, go and watch and get confused.
Well, when we find out more information about that, we will tell you, folks. But after the break, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about how come some venerable old men hate Marvel movies?
I don't know if they hate it, but. Critique.
Well, I think they said they hated it. So here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Faik Shazwan, and Sim Wee Boon. And now, hello. Sim.
Marvel comic-inspired movies, or you know, Marvel movies like superhero movies. So recently, two very venerable directors, and I think it's more than two now, probably a whole bunch of others, Martin Scorsese and, you know, Francis Ford Coppola came out to show their disdain of superhero movies, you know. They said it had nothing to do with cinema, it's not art. I think one of them used the word despicable to describe it. And it has caused a lot of, a debate online, you know, on my social media, you know. That on one side, it's people that are like, obviously in line with what they said. And on the other line, there are people that are like, you know, no, Marvel movies are great and stuff like that. And I'm a fan of both sides, like the work that they create. And I just think that it's neither wrong nor right, you know. I mean, at the end of the day, if you're going to categorize something like a Marvel movie or whatever as a movie as art, right, art is subjective, you know. And I take it as like maybe for these two guys, because they've done their work in a certain way for that long time, anything outside of that realm is not really art, or
he's
not really.
You're sitting on the fence. Come on, millennial. culture.
I mean, I'm not gonna diss Goodfellas. I enjoy Goodfellas. You know, I love Goodfellas. You know,
you can diss Jack though.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. That was one of Coppola's later movies. Yeah. He was absolutely one of the greatest filmmakers of all time. Then suddenly not.
I just think that maybe like for Scorsese, you know, and Coppola, and they're kind of missing the point with their criticism.
Okay.
For me personally, I think they're missing the point because, I mean, you guys are like one of the godfathers, you know, of filmmakers, and a lot of the directors of Marvel cinemas that come out to defend it, you know, they didn't come out to say like, you guys, we hate you. No, they come out with a degree of respect towards, their responses are respect, like, I respect you guys, you know, I started my film because of you guys, but you guys are wrong, you know. And I agree with how they responded because I do think that they are mistaken and they missed the point in their criticism because you can't say Marvel film cinemas are not real cinema or not art because the work that pours in, the beauty, the feelings that they evoke are very real. Okay. And, you know, the people that they touch, you know, it might not be 50-year-olds, but, you know, I've seen kids, I've seen, you know, my friends and all, the type of feelings it forces is real. So, you know, I think they missed their point with their criticism. Okay. Yeah.
Fight, are you going to be on the fence on this one?
I think I'm going to be on the fence on this one.
People, yeah. You millennials are just wasting time. Yeah. Okay, then I'm going
to
go for it.
So, no, so because as millennials, we like to have options. We can enjoy.
Yeah.
It's taxi options. Driver. Yeah, and we can also enjoy Joker.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah.
I take that. Okay, fine, fair enough. But I was watching one of the Marvel movies the other day.
I'm not saying all Marvel movies are great.
No, but they're kind of like, you know, much of a muchness. So I was watching one of them. Was it what's the last one? Endgame? No, Fighting. What was it called? It was like Marvel character, definitely the final movie. Final. And I was watching, it's like, this is all right, this is okay. But then I realized that it was like, in my mind, I know that all these Marvel movies, however good they're going to be, can only be a 7. And so this one was like a good 7.
Well, maybe for you, but for some, there are Marvel movies that are a 10.
No, but see, when Coppola made Godfather 1 and 2, these were the biggest selling box office movies in the world at that time.
Yeah, that's because there was only one outlet for that at that time.
Not only that, but it was because biggest box office was determined by the American cinema guy. Now, American box office receipts, I think, takes less than 50% of global takings. So you're making movies, you have to make movies, and I'm not against this, but you have to make movies that are going to work for an international audience. It's going to be big in China. So most people are watching these movies dubbed. So you can't be clever with the language. You can't even be very clever with the emotion, because you've got to hit universally recognizable emotional moods. Whereas, you know, Godfather was Shakespearean. There's some really subtle cues going on there. And so that's why I can only hit a 7, because the emotions that you're talking about the audiences get is because they're such sort of like broad, thick splat of emotion.
No, I disagree, and it
can make you cry. I'm not saying it can't make you cry. A commercial, a 30-second commercial where, you know, a puppy dog kind of does something can make you cry. But it can't reach Godfather Part 2. But then again, no other movie ever will. Because the box office has changed.
Yeah, but then that just makes it feel like the kind of like, what would you say, like the conditions that made Godfather 2, Godfather 1, those movies great, is very dated. And you know, you already set up a condition that no one can fulfill ever, unless I travel back time and I redid the movie.
No, I think what I'm saying is that the conditions that came into play at that time in terms of the budget allowances, etc., were perhaps unique to that moment. Mm. And the box office was wide open to hit. The people who went to the cinema back then was all ages. Now I think the average age of a 13-year-old boy is the average age of a cinema goer. So we're just not going to get those movies again. That's why Scorsese's most recent movie, The Irishman, was picked up by Netflix, not by any of the studios. And it's $170 million, and they spent most of that money on trying to make De Niro look young.
A technology that Marvel, in the making of Marvel movies, pioneered.
Well, then Marvel came in useful.
Yeah, exactly. I just think that, like, maybe it's a progress kind of thing as well. Because, you know, these art cinemas, they progress through time. Movies progress through time.
Wow.
You know, so, I mean, I would say I'm pretty sure, but I guess if I was living in the time where Godfather came out.
Or 1970s.
Yes, you know, my father's time, right? black and white movies without sound, wouldn't really capture me and give me the feelings as it did, as whatever I was watching at that day and age, you know? Sure. So it might be a generational thing.
Yeah, no, it is. But fight, I mean, you earlier we were talking about American movies are foreign. How I think that we're going to have to look, say, Korean movies.
Sure, yeah.
As the kind of places where you can find the depth of cinema, characterization, plot, story, memories of murder.
Mm-hmm.
When I was watching that, I was thinking, this reminds me of Godfather Part 2.
Have you seen Parasite?
Yes. Oh, I've seen Parasite as well.
That's great. It's a great movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
But just on Memories of Murder, it's essentially what the movie that David Fincher wanted to make but never did.
Yeah, actually.
Because but I mean, like, I'm also just kind of tired of, like, American movies.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I mean, like, the narrative is always about, oh, Marvel movies or whatever, whatever kind of media that comes out of America. You know, whereas, you know, we, you know, that doesn't have to be the case.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also a question of resource and, like, a question of availability. So many people can come out to kind of make a film now, to get involved in the process. And because of so many channels, so many platforms, I mean, you can get Netflix-only streaming movies now. It doesn't have to go through the traditional Hollywood route. So through that, and especially this happens in America the most, so you get a lot of that, you know. And it's the same kind of like problem with Marvel as well. They make a lot of movies, and the really good ones are drowned out by the mediocre ones. And I think that's the issue also I have probably with like what Scorsese and all said, is that they seem to lump the entire thing under one category. Whereas, like, you know, there were a few that came out that was really good, and there were a few that was like mediocre.
What's the really good ones then?
Well, it's my favorite one, which is going to be my recommendation later. So I just want to ask one thing. I really want to know what they would say about Bollywood.
Whoa.
Yeah. Yeah. Like Scorsese, what you think about Bollywood?
I don't know what would you want them.
I don't know. Would they lump it, or would they have the same kind of like, oh, this is not art, this is weird.
No,
you know?
I think that Scorsese and Coppola, they're swimming in the same pond as J.J. Abrams and all the others. You know, that it's the same industry. Indian cinema is Indian cinema. It's got a different audience. Yeah. It's got its own money.
That being said, there is also like kind of a conspiracy theory that all of this is just like an anti-Disney, anti-Marvel campaign because of, you know, Disney Plus, and, you know, so Warner is trying to like, no, we did Joker, and, you know, that's real film. You guys aren't doing it right.
I know. I mean, I enjoy like a good comic book movie, you know, Endgame or Joker or Logan.
Yeah, yeah.
But I also kind of like relate to the sentiment where you can get kind of jala.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, because there's like a movie coming out every month. X-Men next month, Spider-Man, you know. So I understand the kind of that
Yeah, but
reaction.
Then, you know, but you right now, like back then I can understand, like, if you miss watching that movie, you'll miss watching that movie. You have to wait for it to like come out on tape, or like, I don't know, laser disc or whatever that type of device is, you know. Now it's like, you know, I'm just going to wait a month, it's going to come on Netflix. So if you get sick of it, you can take a step back and not miss out.
Right.
Because eventually you can consume it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to wrap this one up. So I have the last word, and I say, you know, they don't make them like they used to. And why can't we have good movies like Grease or Grease 2?
I'm sure they do. Not Marvel, that not maybe not Marvel.
Really bad movie.
Or Xanadu.
It seems. I think the movie with Robert Pattinson, Lighthouse or something like that. People are like, I haven't watched it, but people are saying they're praising the cinematography, and, you know, maybe it's like what they used to.
Thank you for throwing me a bone.
Yeah, it's black and white.
Oh, thank you, Simway. So I'm going to move on though to recommendations, and we recommend something you think might be of interest. And I go first. My recommendation, very simple, is Rex Cinema, down on Jalan Sultan, which is parallel to. Oh, it's producer Ali, reminds me. It's now called Rex KL.
Yes.
And it's parallel to Platanian Street, down in the old Chinatown area. It's I really hope that it's going to succeed. I don't know how well it's doing.
It still
feels kind of dangerous, though. There's no, like, railing.
Yeah.
I love the space.
Yeah, I like
didn't
it too,
mean
yeah.
to kind of, like...
It's very bare and open.
I think the space, I think, is a really, really nice piece of architectural salvage. Really open, as you say. Completely spare, open brick walls. The ceiling's up there. You can still
breezy.
And also you can still see there was a big fire there. So you can still see the black. So
they didn't spend much on renovation, basically.
So I think it's great. It's a great venue for events, etc.
They have really cool events there.
Yeah,
I've been to a couple. I'm not sure if Backlane Cinema was there, or it's somehow involved, but really cool, you know. I mean, there's a couple of food places and bars there that, you know, check out as well.
Yeah. So, you know, go out and support your local...
X-Cinema.
And venue that's really, you know, trying, really.
They should screen a Marvel movie there.
Okay, anyway, Rex KL. Do check it out, folks. I think it's a really interesting space. Fike.
My recommendation, and I hope I'm pronouncing this guy's name right, is he's a singer-songwriter. His name is Ed Askew.
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 Yeah.
I hope. Yeah. That's. And his album called For the World, I just stumbled upon this album through the magic of Spotify's algorithm. It's a really good album.
Yeah.
He's kind of like a outsider artist type of person, but his songs are really nice.
Where's he from?
American.
He's an
American
guy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, Sim is showing us the he wears a cowboy hat.
Yes.
So Ed Askew, I love the fact that we are so algorithmable, even on our outsiderness. So we'll check it out. Perhaps we can persuade producer Ali to allow us to play. Yes, he says yes. We can play out with an Ed Askew track. I mean, if you have one in mind.
Sure. Yeah.
So Sim, what's your?
I'm going to recommend my favorite Marvel movie,
is
Thor Ragnarok. Which was directed by Taika Waititi, one of my favorite directors.
Yeah.
And I loved it because it was fun, it was whimsical, it was there were sad moments, there were happy moments, and you know, if there comes a time where I'm like 50, I might use that as a phrase, and like they don't make him like you used to it, but refer to this.
Well, yeah, okay. Thor Ragnarok. I preferred, as a director, I certainly preferred his Hunt for the Wilder People.
Yes, that was a great movie. I really liked that as well. What We Do in the Shadows as well.
Yeah. Did he do
Flight of the Conchords as well? Is he part of the gang?
No. He has a new movie out, Jojo Rabbit.
Jojo Rabbit.
Yeah, that looks really good.
He's like the only New Zealander not involved with Flight of the Conchords. Okay, so Thor Ragnarok. Well, there's one from Sim's rocking chair memory of how they used to make them in the old days. And so that brings us to the end of this week's episode. We're going to play out with an Ed Askew song. Which one's it?
Blue-Eyed Baby.
And only remains for me now to thank special guests, Sim Weeboon.
Good to be here.
And Faik Shazwan. And myself, Cam Raslan. Please join us next week for another episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Blue-eyed baby cries in the cradle. Mama said to Papa, look at them eyes. Over the ocean, in a great ship, the captain said to the cabin boy, look at that water.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.